coming up on Golf Today, major number two for Lilia Vu. The UCLA Bruin doubles up at Walton Heath. What is her superpower and what is her staying power as the new number one? And two straight wins for Lucas Glover begs a very important question. Has he done enough right now without another shot struck to have a spot on the U.S. Ryder Cup team, or do you need to see more? And who knows more about the Ryder Cup than Lanny Watkins? We'll ask him about Lucas, about winning the PGA, and the state of pro golf. Oh, the possibilities are juicy on Golf Today.
Golf Today.
How are you? This is Golf Today, and it's Monday. David Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week magazine. The major championship season has come to a close.
It might have come to a close, Damon, but the bankers haven't lost interest yet. The next couple of weeks, we're going to see who gets the biggest check in the history of this game. $18 million at stake for somebody next week in Atlanta.
Lots still to play for. It was just last week that we were sitting here recapping Lucas Glover's Wyndham Championship victory as he won on the PGA Tour for the fifth time and moved up, what, 63 spots from 112 to 49 in the FedEx Cup standings to qualify. On Sunday evening, Lucas met the media to talk about his journey.
If you think back to where you were two, 3 months ago, is this at all hard to believe? I know you've been through the process, but I'm shocked.
Yeah. I mean, if you'd have told me this 3 months ago, I'd tell you you're crazy. But at the same time, if you asked me legitimately, did I think I was capable, I'd say yes. And even then, just one of those sad ways athletes are wired. We always believe in ourselves, no matter how bad it is. And I never gave that up, but middle of May, it was hard to go to the range some days and hard to work, but we pushed through and did it anyway.
Take us back to June and you're trying to qualify for the U.S. Open. That was a playoff, and you missed a short putt to not get in. I started to bring that up, but I think it turned out to be a positive in the end. Could you take us from that to where you are now? I mean, it seems like you built off of that. You didn't lose faith in what you were trying to do.
Yeah. Walking back to the car after missing that putt, it was my dad was there and Tommy was with me, obviously. And Tom just looked at me and goes, I don't really care that you missed that putt. This is a process with this new putter. And there's going to be some bumps. But he said, I can't tell you how much better you look and how much more confident you look. And I needed to hear that at that moment, even though I was kind of dejected, and went on to Canada and had my best week in a few months. I believe it was that same week. So, I missed one yesterday on 16, but it's not that nervy, yippy stroke. It's just a bad stroke. It's just like missing the green with a 7-iron. It's just physical. It happens. So just knowing that, it's freer.
What do you think it shows about you that not only did you keep going, but at 43, you're playing some of the best golf of your life?
Maybe I'm really stubborn. 10 years up until this run, I underachieved and knew it. And it was all because of putting. You know, I won the deer. It's because I hit in the grip a bunch, for a week, basically, and snuck them in somehow, but it was just believing myself and hard-headed and stubborn enough to not give up. Never really thought about it, honestly. It was just, I'll figure it out, and it took something drastic to figure it out, but it's worked, obviously.
You talked about it being difficult going to the range back in May. Was there ever a time that you considered quitting? And what do you love about this career that kept you going?
I love competing. Answer your first question. No, I never gave any thought to hanging them up completely, no. Taking some time away, sure, but never just hanging it up.
What do you love about this career?
I just like to compete. I like to compete, and I like being around the guys, and it's more fun when you play well, obviously, but just like the, I like the journey. You know, every week's a different week. Every event's a different event. You got different course, different grass, different wind. It's fun. Except for when I have to do my laundry, then it's not that fun. But I enjoy it. I enjoy being out here, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, honestly.
The journey is fun, Lucas Glover says. Well, it certainly is these days. Entering the Wyndham Championship, he was 112th in the FedEx Cup standings, far outside the top 70 who would make it to the FedEx St. Jude. The win put him at 49th. And entering the Tour, the BMW Championship this week, he's up to fourth. Damon really has a chance to go from being so far out of the conversation about even the top 70 to being potentially the guy who's going to walk away as the best player on the PGA Tour this season. We just saw the graphic of the rarefied era he's in, in terms of back-to-back wins in the 40s. Vijay Singh, Hales, Irwin, that's pretty elite company.
Yeah, sometimes players get better in their 40s. I think Vijay Singh is an example. He won 22 times in his 40s. Kenny Perry won 3 times in his 30s, won 11 times north of 40. Of course, Hale Irwin won a U.S. Open at the age of 45. Now, Lucas is 43. We don't know where this 40s decade will ultimately end up. He won 3 times before the age of 40. He's won 3 times since turning 40. But sometimes players with wisdom, with heartbreak, even with yips, are able to find something sweeter on the other side. Vijay Singh battled putting problems. He changed putters sometimes during tournaments. He would switch from one putter Thursday to a different putter on Friday. But to see this player who's had heartbreak inside the ropes, challenges outside the ropes, I think that this is a game that you could obviously find something even when you would think in other athletes, other sports are slowing down in their 40s.
And he's actually won more times in his 40s than he did back in his 20s.
Yes.
And what's remarkable, we know, we can talk about a lot of statistics, and we just saw some of them in terms of his climb up the FedEx Cup rankings, and we can talk about how he's making himself more relevant in the tour, even in this Ryder Cup conversation that's going on around him. But the numbers don't really tell a full story. There is no strokes gained metric for fortitude. And that, to me, is what is most impressive about Lucas Glover right now, because it's easy to forget when he's swinging this long putter how good he is now over the last couple of weeks, really since the Memorial when he changed to it. He's really started to show numbers where he's top 20 almost every week in putting. And it's easy to forget how bad he was. And he talks about it quite openly. Let's take a look at a video of just how bad the yips were. This is maybe a foot and a half, but look at it from the different angle and see what a yip stroke does. He barely catches the heel of the putter from a foot and a half, and the ball doesn't come anywhere close to hitting the hole.
Mm.
So when you're in a position like that, to get to where he is now, where you suddenly have absolute confidence over putts of any distance, but particularly those, to me, that's just not something you can measure in terms of strokes gained performance. It does not tell a story.
The putting performance on the back nine yesterday, the par saves, the bogey saves. He was 12th in strokes gained putting this week, first in strokes gained total. But the fight and the fortitude that he showed. And I thought that Amanda brought up a great question. Anyone would have said, hey, you could wear down. Take a week off, big guy. You know, it was stressful enough just to get into the playoffs, just to win the Wyndham, having overcome what you did. But when you're making 30-footers and 25-footers on the back nine in the playoffs, and who
for pars
and bogeys, and who's chasing you? Rory? Spieth? Cantlay? Fleetwood? I mean, this is not a fluke, ladies and gentlemen. This is a 43-year-old who is having a career renaissance. And I believe when you match the ball striking with the confident putting, there's no reason why he can't continue to play well outside of Chicago and in Atlanta.
And if you want to know just how quickly the tide shift in this game, Damon, this is a guy who is 1 week away from perhaps being the best player on the PGA Tour for the year, was not good enough to make the field in a single major championship in 2023.
It's amazing. And has also worked his way into the United States Ryder Cup conversation. Let's take a look at the standings. As you know, 6 automatic qualifiers, 6 picks coming for Captain Zach. Lucas has moved up to 16th on the Ryder Cup standings and talked about the possibility of donning the red, white, and blue.
and I know this is capping kind of fast, but in the last, I don't know, five starts, has the Ryder Cup gotten on your mind at all?
About 15 minutes ago.
What'd you think?
I think I've never made it, and I want to.
And if you, I think you'd have to win next week to earn your spot onto the team. If you don't, would you pick you?
Right now, yes. Playing pretty good golf, and I think I'd be pretty good in the team room and be a good partner. So, yeah, absolutely, I would.
You heard the man. Time for a little buy or sell. Buy or sell, Lucas Glover will be on that U.S. Ryder Cup team.
I'm not quite ready to buy that one yet, Damon. I mean, right now, there are, you know, we know there are going to be six guys locked in after the BMW Championship this week. So next Monday, we will know who half the team is. They will be the only guys who can claim a spot on that team, who can be said to have earned a spot on that team. Everything else is up for grabs.
Still?
He has earned a spot in the conversation as well. He has one great thing going for him, which I think has become really clear in the last couple of weeks, and particularly clear yesterday, is Lucas Glover's not scared of anyone. Doesn't matter who he's going up against, who's chasing him. He's not scared of him. Flip side of that is Lucas Glover doesn't necessarily scare anyone either. He's a very solid player. He doesn't have an intimidation value. And Zach Johnson has a wealth of options coming up now. And there's a conversation going around, you know, maybe the top eight or the top 10 are locked in. I don't believe that at all. I think the top six will be locked in, but there are at least 8, 9, 10 guys competing for those last six slots out there. Lucas Glover is certainly one of those guys.
Lucas is the perfect addition to this team of guys that are trying to do something that hasn't been done since 1993, go on the road and win. This is someone who played on two President's Cup teams with Zach Johnson, the captain. They are peers. Zach Johnson knows what's inside that belly and that soul, the fire you talked about Justin Thomas having. Lucas Glover has it as well. This is the reason why the PGA of America moved the qualifying till after the playoffs. So you don't have a situation that we had in 2014 where Billy Horschel was playing outside of his mind. You remember what happened? Cherry Hills, BMW. He goes on, he wins. Then he wins the FedEx Cup, doing that gator chomp in Atlanta. Let's go back. Tour champion. Remember those pants? But you know what? Tom Watson's team was set. This didn't matter. We know what happened to that American squad. They needed the form, the heat index that Billy Horschel had. So the rule was changed to allow for a player like Lucas Glover, who's playing better than anybody on the planet right now, to have a spot on that team. You don't want to make that mistake and let a player like this, who's playing so well, sit. And I know it may come down to a Justin Thomas or Lucas Glover, and that's why making the playoffs was so important, that Zach would be able to see what the players can do as we get closer and closer to Italy.
I think I disagree with you in saying that Lucas Glover has the same fire as Justin Thomas. I think he's got the same determination, that same gritty resolve.
And he shows it in a different way.
Maybe he does, but it's a lot easier to find a player who's in form than it is to find a leader in the locker room. And Lucas Glover's going to have the respect of anybody on that team when he's there. But is he this kind of inspirational leadership figure that JT could become and has been? This talisman character?
I think he can in a different way, though. As the veteran who's been there, as the guy who's sitting next to you in that locker room who's overcome the most scary, frightening thing, the boogeyman in golf is yips. It's the boogeyman in sports is yips. And that guy overcame it. That's the guy who's been kicking my butt the last couple of weeks on the PGA Tour. Yeah, I want to sit next to him. I want that guy hitting 15-footers to save par. I want that guy hitting fairways and greens on a bandbox golf course that you know Luke Donald and company are going to set up to take out the driver and the big weapons that the Americans usually wield so well.
I think form is clearly going to be one of the major components of the decision-making that Zach Johnson is going to have to rely on here. And clearly form puts Lucas Glover a lot higher up in the rankings than 16th or wherever he is now.
Yeah.
He's going to be a lot more relevant in that respect than, say, a Cam Young or Sam Burns, guys like that. But in terms of fire, that's the other component you want, that leadership element in there and in the locker room. And I don't think Lucas is going to score as many points in that column as he will in form. I still think he's in the conversation. He can earn that spot over the next week for sure. I'm not convinced he has it yet. There's Americans just too many other options.
Americans need putters. They need putters in the Ryder Cup. And that aspect of JT's game has been missing. By his own admission, it's been a struggle for him. We've just watched a guy rolling in 30-footers like they were nothing in the playoffs. Playoffs? Doesn't that count for something?
It counts for a lot. But, again, six guys will have sealed their fate by next month. He has the chance to do that. I think if it's left to the option of a captain's pick, then nobody who is in that category can really claim to have been somehow cheated out of a place on the team that was deserved. Everyone's had the chance to earn it. He's making a late run, terrific run, career-defining run, perhaps, but he hasn't earned that spot yet.
Joining the likes of Vijay Singh and Hale Irwin, 40-somethings to go back-to-back. We want to hear from you, the viewer. Should Lucas Glover get a United States Ryder Cup captain's picks a way in on our poll? Will reveal the results at the end of the show. Speaking of Europe, today the DP World Tour announced its schedule for 2024, one which will feature a minimum of 44 tournaments in 24 different countries and across five continents, with members competing for an overall record prize fund of $148.5 million. Pardon me. So let's take a look at some of the schedule notes. The season will comprise five global swings. You got the opening swing, international swing, Asian swing, European swing, closing swing, five Rolex Series events. Those are elevated purses, two new tournaments, and that record prize for $148.5 million, excluding the majors, Eamon.
Yeah, and it makes the PGA Tour schedule look delightfully simple by comparison, Eamon. It's quite a convoluted schedule they have, but in some ways it does actually mirror the PGA Tour schedule, including trying to encourage more PGA Tour players to play more in Europe after the FedEx Cup points race has wrapped up in late August of next year. Well, it's deja vu all over again. In the women's game, Lilia Vu took down her second major championship of the season yesterday. We'll have more on the AIG Women's Open at Walton Heath right after this short break. Now, for the first time in her career, Lilia Vu has reached the world number one spot in the Rolex Women's World Rankings. As of the latest update, she becomes the 17th different player to reach number one and the fourth American since the inception of the Rolex rankings back in 2006. And yesterday, after the victory, she was asked if this was something she ever imagined achieving.
No, honestly, I just wanted to win golf tournaments out here on LPGA, and it's just been a crazy year for me, just doing pretty well at the beginning of the season and just kind of hit a lull in the middle, just struggling. I thought at the US Open, after I played so bad, I didn't know if I could ever win again.
Was there ever a time when you were at a low during your professional career and your parents said something, "Now come along, you're going to be fine," or just give us an idea of what your family were feeling?
Yeah, just a lot of things. 2019, my rookie year, was really hard for me. I just put a lot of pressure on myself to perform really well, and I would just get down on myself when I didn't. And then a lot of things, I just went back down to Symetra Tour, and I couldn't even contend there. I was almost dead last at every event. I wanted to put the clubs away and maybe do something else, but my mom, she was always told me that I was good enough to compete out here and be the best. And she's really my rock and the reason why I'm here. And then also with my grandpa passing away at the beginning of COVID. And I remember I was on my way to a tournament. I had saw him in the hospital before I left, and he was okay. It was a little scare, and he told me to just go out there and play my best before my tournament. Meanwhile, he's sick and he's worrying about me and my golf game. And then by the time I came back, he had passed, and those were his last words to me. And I just always think about that every single day. Even when I'm struggling out there on the course, I know he's out there with me, just letting me know that it's gonna be okay.
UCLA's Lilia Vu, a two-time major winner, bookend major, Chevron and AIG, joining Ronan Yin, Allison Corpuz, and Celine Boutier as major winners in 2023. And Grant Boone joins us now. He was on the call. Grant, great to see you. What was the discussion Sunday night, TV compound, Liliavu wins her second major of the year?
Yeah, Damon, the talk was that finally someone broke that trend that we've had for the last several years. 21 of the last 22 majors had gone to different winners. Minji Lee is the only other one who had won multiple majors in that stretch. And now Liliavu has won two in the same year. We've been waiting for someone to assert their dominance in the women's game. We've seen Jin Young Ko be great. We've seen Nelly Korda rise to number one. Lydia Ko got back there at the end of last year, the beginning of this year. But in terms of winning majors, only Minji had won more than one over the last 4 years. And now Lilia, who had not won at all at the LPGA Tour coming into the year, has won three times two majors and ascends to number one in the world.
Grant, you mentioned Lilia had not won at all starting this year. So I assume if we went back to January and told you that one American player was going to win two majors this year, she wouldn't have been on your list of guesses?
Not necessarily. And the only reason I would say that, Eamon, is because last fall, Lilia played in the final group on Sunday in three consecutive LPGA events. She had a terrific season. So did Alison Corpuz, by the way, who also won a major this year. Lilia was trending towards victory. And so you could have sold me on that for sure. I'm not saying I predicted it, but it was not a shock. Lilia, by the time last year ended, had worked her way, inside the top 50 in the world rankings and just kept climbing as the year went on last year after just a completely dreadful, beginning to her LPGA career in 2019, a year in which she only made one cut and nearly quit the game. And so for Lilia, though she didn't win to get into the mix, final pair, final group at least, three consecutive events, we saw that this potential was there. And certainly what we saw from her as an amateur led us to believe that she could be great. And has she ever been great this year?
Well, 59th in driving distance this season, second in putts per green. What is her superpower, Grant?
Yeah, I think her superpower is in not having any super weakness. How about that? She's 260 plus off the tee, so you say 59th in distance, but she's got plenty of length. There's no shortage of distance for Lilia off the tee. And she is an absolute winner. I mean, she's a collegiate superstar at UCLA. I don't think you forget how to win. We've watched that in the men's and women's games over the year. Lydia Ko did that last year. We saw her rise back to dominance. And so Lilia, when she gets, a chance now, I think she feels like she has at least as good a chance, if not better, than anyone. And I think something's interesting, and Morgan Pressel and I talked about this as she was coming up the 18th hole with, at the time, a 5-shot lead. She made that putt on 18 for a 6-shot victory. When she won in Thailand, she was 6 shots back going into the final round. And she was playing against a couple of Thai players. Nathakrita Wongtawilap was leading, and Ataya Titagun, who had been number one at the end of last, toward the end of last year, they were up there ahead of her. But I think when you start 6 back, you can let it rip. And if you shoot 73, nobody says, what happened? They just say, you finished whatever you finished. She wins. And then she gets to Chevron, tied for 11th, 4 back, going in to that final round outside Houston. And, she winds up winning a playoff with Angel Yin. That's one thing. It's all credit to her because, as we saw for all those years, as great as Tiger was, he never won a major when coming from behind until he won his last one in 2019. That takes something special. But it's a very different thing when you stand on the first tee in the final game of the day, late tee time on Sunday, and you're in the final game with a player that 99% of the gallery hopes will win and is cheering for to win, Charlie Hull in this case. Stand up there to birdie the toughest hole all week, the second hole. Brilliant shots. There were no birdies on the second hole on Saturday, hardly any on Sunday. She had one of them. She took the lead on Sunday with that birdie at 2. She never was even tied the rest of the way. That tells you something about Liliavu. So to come from behind, yes, very impressive. But to win from in front on a huge stage with everyone cheering for your opponent. That's sporty.
Certainly going to be interesting, Grant, to see if she is the one who ends this parody that we've been talking about in the women's game over the last couple of years. And in conversations about that, we've tended to focus on people like Jin Young Ko and Nelly Korda, Lydia Ko. Who do you think's actually going to have the longest, coldest winter waiting for the majors to come around again? Who's just going to feel a sense of disappointment after the 2023 season?
I think that's a really good question. And you might say Lydia Ko, but I think for Lydia, it's not just the majors that she's frustrated with. Lydia, in many ways, feels lost with her game right now. Extremely happy off the golf course. Got married last December. And I don't think you ever know how someone's going to respond after, you know, having, something positive like that, but definitely a change in her life. It's a new routine for her with her husband, June. And so you don't know. She won very early on the Ladies European Tour, but it's really had a dreadful LPGA season, her worst LPGA season, actually, since she joined the tour as a pro 9 years ago. And of course, let's not forget, she won a couple of events as an amateur before she turned pro. In terms of the majors, I'm going to say it's Jin Young Ko. And the reason is Jin Young won two majors like Lilia Vu did back in 2019. She hasn't won any since. And Jin Young has won twice this year. Morgan and I talked about this on the broadcast, and Tom Abbott as well. It's been a strange year for Jin Young Ko, because though she did win twice early in the season, then in the late spring at the Cognizant Founders Cup, when she came from behind to beat Minji Lee and won in a playoff, we entered the major championship summer, let's say. The Chevron was late April, and she was around. She wound up top 10-ing, if memory serves, but it was a backdoor top 10. She was really never in contention. But you go into Baltusrol, and then you go into Pebble Beach and Evian, where she's won before, and then Walton Heath. Her caddy, Dave Brooker, is from England and knows that course. I think you would have certainly said that Jin Young Ko was going to pick off a major for sure. She got to Pebble Beach a week and a half before the championship began, and she shot 79 in the opening round. And it could have been a case in which she maybe over-practiced a little bit. She's had some frustrating injuries, maybe from overwork, a shoulder, a back. She had the wrist injury this time last year. Certainly where she was this time last year when she was taking some time off because of that wrist injury and was really struggling, you'd say she's in a much better place. But I think Jin Young is the one who's feeling the frustration. She was kind of around the mix there at Baltusrol, but didn't have a great weekend. And she actually went into the weekend, you know, at Walton Heath with at least a shot, and did not play her best. What we've seen with Jin Young Ko this year, we've seen the highs, the two wins, but we've seen a lower floor than we're accustomed to seeing, when she was at her best. To be fair, when she was at her best, she was doing things that literally no one has done in the history of golf. 114 straight holes without a bogey, 63 straight greens in regulation, silly stuff. So maybe that's an unfair comparison. She's fine. Jin Young Ko's fine. But to your question, longest winter, you know, it's going to be late April before the next major. I think it's Jin Young Ko.
Well, it's a compelling week at Walton Heath. Grant, thanks so much for the time today.
Eamon, great to talk to you. Cheerio.
Now, today marks a special anniversary for another one of our colleagues, one of the best to ever do it, Lanny Watkins. More on his breakthrough major in 1977. Plus, we'll get his thoughts on the state of the men's professional game when Golf Today returns. Let's get a look on this date in history, because it was back in 1977, I want to say. Yanks beat my Dodgers in the World Series. Lanny Watkins beat Gene Littler in sudden death to win the PGA at Pebble Beach for his major championship. A giant moment in what would be a storied Hall of Fame career. 21 PGA Tour wins in all. Won that 77 PGA Championship. Played on 8 U.S. Ryder Cup teams between 1977 and 93, and captained the 95 U.S. Ryder Cup team and inducted in the World Golf Hall of Fame with a great speech in 2009. And great to have the World Golf Hall of Fame member, our colleague Lanny Watkins, with us. I always wanted to ask you, by the way, about the 18th hole at Pebble. You know, it's a dream hole, bucket list, but that hole, you know, seen a lot of interesting history. How'd you approach that hole over the course of the PGA?
Well, back then, Damon, I really didn't hit it long enough to ever reach that green in two. I don't think anybody playing the tour at that point in time did. Ball just didn't go that far. The trees that are in the fairway were actually probably 20 or 25, maybe even 30 yards closer to the tree, to the tee. So to really hit a good tee shot, you had to be bold and play it left of the tree off the tee to put it in good position. But the last round, for example, I hadn't made a birdie all day. I eagled both par fives on the front, 2 and 6. I had not made a birdie and thought I had missed it. I missed about a 12-footer for birdie at 17 that I thought I needed to make to have a chance. I hit a good drive at 18, laid up with 4 iron. I remember I had 92 yards to the flag, and the big scoreboard behind the green, I looked at it right before I hit my shot and saw Littler had bogeyed 16. I knew that if I birdied right here and now, I would be tied with him, and he still had 17 and 18 to play. I hit wedge to about 2 feet and giggled the putt in the side door and survived Nicklaus missing a putt at 18 to tie me. And then Litt he made a great par, I understand, at 17, and he didn't have a really makeable birdie putt at 18.
That was the first sudden death playoff in the history of the majors you won, Lanny. That was your only major title. I know you tend to be pretty clear-eyed when you look back at your career. You were second 4 times. You were third 4 times as well. When you think back on it now, how many majors should you have finished your playing career with?
Well, so I mean, my count and other people's are probably very Damon. I mean, but it's I don't know. I felt like I had some really good chances. I had a chance at a couple of Masters, one particular, a U.S. Open especially. Then I did lose another PGA in a playoff to Larry Nelson in '87. So I had my chances there. I just don't think I ever quite made enough putts. And, you know, we didn't have a team. We tended to do stuff on our own back then. I should have spent more time with Phil Rogers. He changed my putting in 81 going into 82. I actually won 3 times the next year working with Phil. And I wish that I had spent more time with him. Once I kind of got a feel for what he was telling me, I tried to do it on my own. And I should have spent probably 2-3 weeks a year with him on probably short game and putting. Could have made a big difference.
Lanny, no one's making more putts right now than Lucas Glover. Has he earned a spot on that team via captain's pick in your mind today, or do you need to see more?
You know, he's a competitive son of a gun, and I am so happy for Lucas. I got to know Lucas. He and I both worked with Dick Harmon back in the day, and we both were, you know, saddened and, you know, probably one of the greatest people we ever knew in Dick Harmon. And Lucas was really, really close to Dick. I'm sure Dick's looking down right now and, you know, really happy for Lucas. And I am too. Lucas is a wonderful man, and he is a ball striking machine. The putter looks solid right now. I think I'd have to lean with him. I think this is the reason there are captain's picks, Heyman. They didn't have them, and now they've got them set up so that they're made late in the year to get the guys that are hot on the team. We didn't have captain's picks until 1989. Raymond Floyd made the original first two picks, picked me and Tom Watson. We were the first two captain's picks for the United States ever. I made my first Ryder Cup team in 77, winning the PGA because the PGA champion was automatic. In fact, I stood on the first tee at Pebble, and Don Padgett, president of PGA, told Gene Littler and I said, by the way, boys, whichever one of you two guys wins today, you're going to be on the Ryder Cup team. You're going to knock Al Geiberger off the team. So that was how I made my first one in 77.
Lanny, the Ryder Cup was also in the news last week as well. Billy Walters, Vegas gambler, brought out a memoir in which he alleged that Phil Mickelson wanted to bet on the 2012 Ryder Cup team, on which he was a playing member. Phil put out a statement saying he did not place a bet on that Ryder Cup team. Are allegations like that concerning to you, that in any way there could be a potential history of great players betting on tournaments in which they're involved?
Very disconcerting, Eamon, no question. It's You know, I don't know that there's ever been a more disappointing figure in golf than Phil Mickelson, seeing what's transpired with him over the last 10-plus years. I mean, he was a beloved figure for a long time. We all marveled at the way he could play, but just nothing looks kosher about what he's doing these days. He's blown a chance to probably be Ryder Cup captain ever. I think he would probably have been a two-time captain. Now he's not going to be involved. It's really kind of a shame. You know, he's just self-imploded and looks like he just continues to at every turn. It's disappointing and sad. It's sad that we have people in our game that think they're bigger than the game, and obviously Phil thinks he's bigger.
Landon, we spoke to Hal Sutton last week, who said that this is symptomatic of just greed, that the PGA Tour right now, there's too much talk of money. Hal said in his day, the talk was charity, charity, charity. Is Hal Sutton right?
100%, yes. I totally agree with Hal. I even texted him after I saw his interview. I texted Hal after the interview, and I said, great job, man. You hit it right on the nose. And I agree with that. I don't understand why the tour had, for example, had to jump purses to the amount they did this year and put themselves in a position that was uncomfortable, you know, going to $20 million purses. I mean, they went from, you know, these guys wouldn't have been good enough playing for 12, 15 million. I mean, come on. You know, it's a little disappointing. It really is. It's, I don't know where that mindset is coming from, but, it's a little unsettling to a lot of us who've been around the game for a long time.
We had the leadership of the PGA of America on the show last week as well, Lanny, as they explained why they want the governing bodies to pump the brakes on this idea of doing anything about the distance the golf ball flies. The tour said the week earlier that they were not going to adopt any local rule that might come in along those lines. Do you think the governing bodies need to pump the brakes or back off, or should they just carry on?
I don't think they carried on enough, Eamon. I think the ball's gotten so far to control, it's unbelievable. I think if you look at what they're talking about with the ball, you know, limiting, they're talking about speeds and ball speeds and swing speeds that players don't even have yet. They're thinking, you know, down the road 5-6 years when people are swinging faster, hitting it further. I think it should have gone the other direction. I have long maintained that, you know, the one thing that changed the golf ball, changed the trajectory, was the PGA Tour losing the lawsuit to Carsten Solheim on square grooves. Had we never gone to square grooves, the ball never could have gotten to where it is now. And they just have not, it has not maintained the integrity of the game. And I think the ball flies too far. You know, it's sad. The worst thing about it is watching some of these courses that are so magnificent not be able to contain today's players. And I mean, I watch every year on tour, obviously a lot of courses that I won on, and I'm thinking about the clubs I hit, and I may have been hanging a 4-iron on a hole, and today's guys have 115 yards to the flag. It's just surprising and disappointing. And there's so many great venues that are just, you know, not realistic challenges anymore.
Different game on many levels. Lanny, thanks for the time and candor. As always, speak to you soon.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Well, cut day on the PGA Tour is usually Friday, but in the playoffs, it moves to Sunday. The season ended for 20 guys yesterday at the FedEx St. Jude Championship. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at those who are heading on to Chicago and those who are just headed home. Megan Schofield joins us now, and this is the best Monday morning flex we're going to see in a while, Megan. That gold medal around your neck. Congratulations on the victory. I know you played the women's amateur quite a few times. What did those past experiences contribute to what you needed yesterday?
I felt like going into this event, I was playing really solid golf. I felt like my swing was in a good spot, but playing championship golf is something that you can only experience. And I feel like playing in really great college events and playing in 5 previous USAMs have all prepared me for this past week. I felt like any USGA style golf course is going to be tough. Fairways and greens are always a really important part, and that's kind of the strength of my game. I feel like when I'm playing well, I hit a lot of fairways, and my irons are usually a really great part of my game.
Megan, I imagine that locker room gets a little bit quieter and quieter as the week wears on and players go home. What's that vibe like as the numbers dwindle throughout the week?
Yeah, for sure. We my boyfriend and I talked about it a lot. Like, when we made it to the quarterfinals, you're like, wow, this place feels like such a ghost town. Then we made it to the semis. And when there was just Latana and I was like, oh my goodness, like, this whole golf course is just set up for the two of us. It just was crazy. Like, it really is a weird feeling, but it was really fun to be able to do that.
I'm curious what the nerves were like the night before the final, Megan, because I read somewhere that your boyfriend's alarm almost got him fired as caddy and boyfriend.
Yeah, so I was pretty anxious the night before the final round, as I feel like most people would be. But yeah, his whoop alarm went off at like 4 a.m. and I had already had a really hard time going to sleep the night before. And once I'm up, I'm up. And so I never went back to sleep after that. And I was quite hot that morning, but obviously it worked out. That's what he kept telling me. He's like, well, it didn't affect you too much. Like, you can't be that mad.
Our second whoop mention on this show with Dom Chu. Whoop, there it is. Hey, Megan, I got another question for you. I've read that you're a bit of a superstitious type. What are some of your superstitions that involve golf?
So when I'm putting, if I'm putting well, like, I'll usually keep the head cover in the same exact spot. So the last three matches, I think the putter head cover had to be on the ground the whole time. The driver head cover has to be sideways on the top of my bag. I can only use white tees from my home course. I wore the same hat the whole week. So did my boyfriend. He wore the same hat from the second day of stroke play on. We ate Chick-fil-A every single morning, except obviously on Sunday, which I was a little stressed about not being able to do that. But yeah, no, the superstitions are, that's just a few of them too. And obviously my parents didn't come, and they were kind of, they wanted to come obviously, but they didn't want to mess me up and change. They had been home all week, so they're like, we're not going to change that up.
Wow, I thought this game had done a number in my head, Damon. This is quite something out here. How difficult was it to separate playing from a friend? Because you've known Latana for quite a long time, right?
Yes, I have. I've known her. She's probably one of my longest golf friends, really. But Latana is a great girl on and off the golf course. So I felt like, for me, Latana was going to treat me the same if I was up or if she was up. I felt like she was going to talk to me the whole time, and I wanted to be able to talk to her. And it kind of just, I mean, golf's just a game. You know, obviously, we both really wanted to win. But at the end of the day, like, there's a lot more that's more important than just golf.
Megan, I understand when Auburn athletes do something very well, they roll Toomer's corner, and the women's golf team did something in support of you. Can you explain what that, not superstition, but tradition is all about?
Yeah, Auburn's all about tradition, and it's all about family. And I had no idea that they were going to do that. Obviously, I wasn't on my phone much, and I get a call from Joan Alexander, our director of ops, and they're all at Toomer's rolling it. And that was such a cool experience, especially since they just reopened those two trees that were poisoned in 2017. So that was such an awesome thing for me. And I'm definitely super thankful that they did that, and just shows how much they care and support me all the time. And it was such an honor, and I'm really thankful for all of them.
We've just seen, Megan, that you have exemptions into four of the five women's majors next year, the Augusta National Women's Amateur. Do you have any ambitions left to accomplish in the women's amateur collegiate game?
Yeah, I'm going to stay this whole year for my fifth year and play one more year at Auburn. And I probably will stay an amateur through the rest of the fall. I'm not really sure exactly when my plans are to turn pro, but yeah, I definitely will stay an am the whole summer. And I probably will play most of those exemptions, and just professional golf's always going to be there. So I don't feel the rush to turn pro just yet.
Well, Megan, it was sure fun to watch. Congratulations on being a national champion.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, when Golf Today continues, the PGA Tour headed to Chicago as the FedEx Cup playoffs continue. When we return, we're joined by our resident Chicago expert and former Chicago Tribune sports writer Teddy Greenstein to talk all things BMW. Stay tuned. Back on Golf Today. Yesterday, Lucas Glover kept his good play rolling right through the first leg of the playoffs, defeated Patrick Cantlay on the first playoff hole to grab his second PGA Tour win in as many weeks. His recent stretch of good play includes five top six finishes in his last six starts. And the win moves Lucas to number four in the FedEx Cup standings as the playoffs head to Olympia Fields for this week's BMW Championship. And the victory also moves Lucas to number 16 in current U.S. Ryder Cup standings, with the top six automatically qualifying for the team. Another six captains' picks to come.
And there's often not much between ecstasy and despair in this game, Damon. Here are those in and out. After the FedEx Endure Championship, Cam Davis shot three great Sunday rounds his last three starts to get himself in, and Tom Hoagie birdied the last three holes at TPC Southwind. Mackenzie Hughes finished in the unlucky 51st spot, and at 52nd was Nick Hardy, who entered the week in the last spot at 50, and afterwards we found out just how much it hurt.
Yeah, I'm proud of myself. Super tough. I really wanted to play Chicago. It just sucks. I mean, it really sucks. It stings right now. I feel like I'm proud of myself for the season. I saw a lot of growth in my game. It's hard to remind yourself of that right now, but I saw a lot of growth in my game. I'm just blessed because I've been blessed with this game so far, and I'm definitely disappointed, but I'm definitely proud of myself.
Mm-hmm. You've been through a lot this season. Just what makes you most proud of yourself right now?
My continued improvement, I would say. I'm definitely just proud of my career so far. Sorry. I'm proud of how I know I'm getting better. It's sometimes it's hard to see growth in this game. But I know I'm seeing it. And I hope to be out here for a long time. And I know I have many more opportunities, but it stings right now. That's what I'm most proud of, is just that I know I'm getting better. It's hard to see it, but you gotta remind yourself of that. And I'm just super grateful for the position I'm in, no matter what. Even though I didn't make it, and I'm not gonna make it, I'm super grateful. I'm super, super grateful for that.
That's why I love sports, the great feats of brilliance, but also the heartbreak and sadness when you don't get the dream that you want.
And that was pretty raw from Nick Hardy there. And there is a lot at stake here, because the top 50 who make the BMW Championship are also the guys who have the guaranteed spots in those signature events next year. And that's a pretty elite ecosystem. If you leave aside the majors, leave aside the players, and if you don't finish in the top 10 in any of their SM, if you finish 11th, in every one of those other events, you're going to make about $5 million for the year. Mm. Making the cut last week in Memphis really has consequences.
Yeah, pressure, a lot of pressure in elite sports. And someone who dealt with pressure expertly is golf's newest national champion after her victory in yesterday's U.S. Women's Amateur Championship at Bel Air Country Club. Megan Schofield joins us with a new trophy in just a little bit.
And that's the venue for the second leg of the FedEx Cup playoffs, which roll on this week to Olympia Fields Country Club in Chicago, which hosts the BMW Championship. It will host a 50-man field, with the top 30 advancing to next week's Tour Championship at Eastlake in Atlanta.
No stranger to hosting some big-time events at Olympia Fields. A couple U.S. Opens, a couple of PGAs besides, U.S. Senior Open, U.S. Amateur, KPMG Women's PGA Championship, the 2020 BMW, and five Western Opens. And Chicago's own Teddy Greenstein, senior editor at PointsBet Sportsbook, joins us now. Teddy, it's great to see you. We know Chicago's a great sports town. How would you describe it as a golf town?
The joke here that we could have an entire PGA Tour just based on Chicago courses, because you've got all these great private courses to the north. You've got Shore Acres and so many brilliant ones there. Then you've got, you know, Chicago Golf out west. Medina is out west, and then Olympia Fields down to the south, which has done an incredible job with its north course. Obviously, when the 2003 U.S. Open was there, it was kind of a dud, and we can touch back on that. But in terms of its love for golf, Chicago is pretty much unmatched.
But the last time the PGA Tour was in Chicago, Teddy, it wasn't exactly a raucous affair out there, was it?
No, and it was such an unusual case. It was a couple months after the pandemic had begun in the summer of 2020. So there were media guys like me and sort of friends and family and volunteers out there. So there were no roars. And as a result of that, even though that tournament produced one of the greatest finishes in golf history, you don't really see the clips that much and you don't hear about it because it was so quiet. It was just like golf claps around the green after, you know, it's a playoff. Dustin Johnson knocks in a 44-footer and John Rahm makes the Rahm bomb 66 feet downhill, side hill. One of the greatest putts ever, but I think because of the lack of fans, it was just so unusual sounding. There was very little reaction after this one went down.
Well, you wrote about it in the Chicago District Golfer. How much is Olympia Fields kind of hankering then to have, you know, peanuts, Cracker Jacks, beer, people, and more great golf this week?
That's the thing, Damon. It's such a big redemption story. You know, going back to that 2003 U.S. Open that was won by Jim Furyk, there was very little buzz. There were a couple 65 shot on Thursday. So, you know, the thought was, oh, this course is too easy, even though I think the USGA was to blame for the setup. There was a lack of wind, but people sort of tuned out of that U.S. Open. Jim Furyk won by 3 shots after bogeying the final 2 holes. Ever since then, Olympia Fields has had incredible events. A USAM won by Bryson DeChambeau, a great KPMG Women's Major won by Danielle Kang. And then this 2020 event, this BMW Championship, was superb because the scores were really high on Thursday and Friday, and yet no one was complaining. Nobody was saying it was tricked up. It was just firm and fast and windy, and even the guys like Mark Leishman, who were finishing near the bottom, were saying this is a great course setup. And of course, it lent itself to an incredible Sunday finish.
And John Rahm's victory, that was a little better ending to the tournament than he had when he lost in the quarterfinals of the U.S. Amateur back in 2015, based on your story.
That's right, good tease there. He had a battle with the locker, and the locker won, as Olympia Fields members like to say it. You know, John Rahm, we love him for his fire, and I think he had even more as a youngster. So he bowed out of that event. By the way, the Olympia Fields clubhouse locker room, if you've been there, is so large it has its own zip code. It's kind of a famous one. There's a lot of lore there in terms of the different sections, and it's an incredible place. So John Rahm had a much better experience there, needless to say, in the summer of 2020.
Well, Teddy, our producer, Chloe, who's from Illinois, says you have the, you know, most Chicago accent she's ever heard. So we want to do some Chicago trivia, if you're game. Are you game with some Chicago sports trivia? And
yeah,
besides Chicago sports.
I'm from New York, but absolutely. I'll take that with a Chicago accent.
Sure. All right, here we go. Who were the 5 different franchises the Jordan-led Chicago Bulls beat in the NBA championship?
I'm going to go with Utah, Seattle, 5 different ones. Lakers. Help me out here on the last 2. What do we got?
Trailblazers and Suns. Not bad. Not bad. Drexler. Remember Drexler? The Portland Trailblazer fans thought that Drexler was better than Jordan. Jordan didn't like that too much.
My excuse, I covered 96 through 98, not 91 through 93. So
there. All right, we'll take you back to your childhood here, Teddy. In the 1986 movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, who does the pizza shop owner say is winning the Cubs game when Principal Rooney asks?
Oh, my God. So is that like with the Sausage King? Is that that scene who's winning the Cubs game? Oh, no, it says, I think, the Bears. Right? Right. And he looks up and, Bears. And I think there's some eyes rolled after that.
Yeah, score 0-0. Exactly. Who are the 2 original NFL teams in Chicago?
So would it be like the Chicago Cardinals and something like the Stags at some point? I think that might have been the name. What were they?
I think Bears and Cardinals, I think, would have been, right?
Bears and Cardinals.
I don't think he's doing very well here. We're going to give you one chance to redeem yourself here, Teddy. What year was deep dish pizza invented in Chicago?
That's really good. So I think it was essentially by the Malnati family. And I'm going to say it was in, like, the 1940s. I'll say 1947.
You know, good enough. 43 is the end. You got the decade right. Pizzeria Uno, I think.
Uno.
Yes.
Uno and Due are wonderful ones. Malnati is great. Boys, you got to come on out. I'm getting hungry. Come on out and visit me.
It's lunchtime. I'm hungry.
He knows a lot about Chicago for a New Yorker.
Exactly. That was very well done. Teddy G, always great to see you, pal. Enjoy the week at the BMW.
Next is New York 80s Jets trivia, where I will really kill it.
Next
great
week.
To see you guys.
See you, buddy.
Well, Gabby Ruffles is one of the fastest rising talents in the game. At the weekend, she announced her 3rd win of the season on the Epson Tour. Gabby's going to join us next to talk about what's coming up. It's time now for a little Golf Today roundtable as we welcome in our colleague Jaime Diaz. And Jaime, there's a lot to chew on in the game these days, but let's start right here with Lucas Glover. Has he done enough to deserve a spot on the Ryder Cup team now, or has he merely earned a spot in the conversation?
Well, I think he's earned himself a favorite spot in the conversation because I think he is the model for which the task force on the Ryder Cup was looking for in terms of getting the hot player. He's done everything possible that you could do late in the season to convince people that he's the right kind of guy to get on the team. And he's done it so impressively by winning twice, obviously, but also improving that thing that was so lacking in his game, which is putting, and so important in the Ryder Cup, and become, I think, convincingly a very good clutch putter. I mean, those were very clutch performances, and just so much to recommend him. He's an old hand now. I mean, look at this, the smoothness of that tempo. It's not a guy who looks yippy at all. And he was holding out the 3- and 4-footers that used to give him so much trouble with great smoothness, too. So I think that's very encouraging. That sort of growth, that sort of clutch, you know, gene and toughness, I think speaks volumes for a guy who can come to the Ryder Cup and handle the pressure. And also be a good example to other players that, hey, you can get through this kind of thing and be a good team room guy who can encourage others. So I just think Lucas, if he just keeps playing pretty well, and gets to the Tour Championship, and nobody ahead of him between, let's say, 13 and or 12 and 13, 15 wins, I think he should be on the team.
Lucas Glover, one big story, and I agree he should be on the team. And another big story, this new Billy Walters book where he alleges that Phil Mickelson bet $1 billion over 3 decades, lost $100 million. Where does that allegation sit with where Phil Mickelson sits in professional golf today?
Well, I think it's actually a secondary consideration based on the big picture, which Phil Mickelson, I think, really did a disservice, as Lanny Watson was talking, to his legacy and to the game of golf by really encouraging LIV to exist, by being available, by recruiting other players to that group and making it bigger than it would have been without him. And he did it, who knows why, but it appears that he needed money. And money was important. And when you look at the gambling debts that probably were incurred, you know, it's not unreasonable to assume it had something to do with it. And so that gambling is what I feel gave Phil this very difficult position to try to negotiate in his personal life that ended up being something that actually affected golf a great deal. As far as the actually placing the bets, I'm not shocked. I mean, if you go to the UK, you can bet on yourself as a player. Mm-hmm. It's totally legal, and nobody says, oh, that's improper, or even bet on your own team if you had a Ryder Cup team, I'm sure. So, I don't know, it didn't offend me that much. It didn't shock me, certainly, that Phil was considering it. It's a heck of a lot of money, and obviously we have a Pete Rose example, and Billy Walters, according to his account, he seized on that quickly. He said, you can't do that. But honestly, it's done all the time in golf in the UK, so it didn't bother me. But what Phil did in the big picture has bothered me, yes.
And Phil did actually respond to that Billy Walters excerpt last week where he issued a statement on social media saying that I never bet on the Ryder Cup, and while it is well known that I always enjoy a friendly wager on the course, I would never undermine the integrity of the game. I have also been very open about my gambling addiction. I have previously conveyed my remorse, took responsibility, have gotten help, have been fully committed to therapy that has positively impacted me, and I feel good about where I am now. I guess my question, Jaime, is there's obviously no evidence that has been offered that Phil Mickelson has ever gambled on golf. Clearly the suspicion is there, but there's no evidence of that. Should this be a matter of concern for the other bodies running tournaments where Phil Mickelson is still competing? LIV also has a no gambling clause in its rulebook. But if you're the PGA of America, the USGA, the Masters, the RNA, Phil's playing all of those events. Should there be some kind of investigation as to whether or not it is an issue?
It's an interesting question because, you know, golf, it's just endemic to golf that we all gamble. You know, I mean, $2 Nassau, whatever. It's part of the culture. I'm not equating that to Phil's amounts, but just the idea that, you know, gambling is bad in golf doesn't really strike me as something, you know, that is so obvious. I think if someone bet on themselves to lose, and you can trace that, yes. But if you're betting on yourself to win, it seems to me that's what golfers do all the time just by being a pro. You're betting on yourself every week, basically.
But it's a slippery slope, isn't it? Because of the inside information that a professional athlete would have. And page 140 of the PGA Tour rulebook explicitly says that you can't. You can't bet. You can't bet on property at events. And you can't bet on events that are co-sanctioned or sanctioned by the PGA Tour.
Well, there it is. I mean, that's a rule.
It's the rule.
It's not a rule in the UK. Again, I don't know how strictly that can ever be enforced.
Yeah.
I would not be shocked at all if he'll bet on golf. And I don't. I think others probably have, too. I don't know this. Obviously, it just feels like it wouldn't be that big a sin, even though it's in the rule book. You never hear about, you know, you hear about, oh, we had a friendly wager, or, yeah, I put some money on this college football game. I don't know how it affects the competition unless you're betting on yourself to lose.
Mm. I want to show you another quote here from, it didn't get as much attention, from another LIV player, Harold Varner III, to my Golf Week colleague, Adam Woodard. He said, I also don't think people on the PGA Tour should get compensated for being loyal. I think that's blank. I don't think anyone should. You had the option to go. And this is an interesting question he's raised here, because it's a very valid argument that there was a business decision to be made. These guys chose one path. The tour loyalists chose another. And you don't get some kind of make good after the fact. The flip side of that is, as Varner has said, as Phil Mickelson has said, that LIV guys aren't that interested in going back to the tour, yet Jay Monahan has created a committee to discuss what are the terms or potential sanctions these guys have. Do you see a scenario where LIV guys are actually ever going to accept sanctions to go back to the PGA Tour? And should the guys who stayed actually be rewarded for it?
I think it ends up being the, what happens in the deal with the framework. If the PGA Tour has the leverage it wants, it would probably like LIV to go away. And if LIV went away, where would those guys want to come play?
Mm-hmm.
They want to come play to the PGA Tour. And so in that case, yes, I could see a scenario. It may be unlikely at this moment because it doesn't appear that the tour has absolute leverage at this moment. But as far as, you know, the former question, you know, should PGA players who stayed get compensated for staying? I thought John Rahm was very explicitly moral in his answer, which is, I made my decision. I factored in everything. I feel good about where I stayed. I'm good. I don't need to be compensated.
And those guys are getting, if you play well, you're getting enough money on next year. I mean, the FedEx Cup winner gets $25 million next year. That's a make good.
Nobody's hurting on the PGA Tour. Jaime, no shortage of things to talk about. We appreciate the time.
Thanks, Dave.
All right, folks, still to come on Golf Today. Gabby Ruffles is back in the winner's circle on the Epson Tour, and she joins us on the other side of the break.
Gabby Ruffles' season on the Epson Tour. Damon, 12 starts, 3 victories, 6 top 10s, just 1 missed cut, and 3 LPGA Tour starts. And Gabby Ruffles joins us now. Gabby, congratulations on the victory. It's noticeable when you look at your schedule for this year that you really focused on the Epson Tour. Those 3 LPGA Tour victories, 2 of them were major championships. Was that a clear decision you made at the outset of the year that this is where you're going to focus on getting that card?
Yes, definitely. At the start of the year, we had a team meeting, and that was the goal. And, you know, the Epson Tour is such a great pathway to get your card and get really good status for the next year. So that was my goal. That's been my goal since I turned pro. And, I feel like I'm, you know, kind of taking good stride in that goal.
Gabby, end of 2022, you missed the entry deadline for LPGA Q Series. But I'm wondering, in some strange way, has that been a blessing?
It definitely has been a blessing. I tell a lot of people this. It's been a kind of a blessing in disguise. You know, being able to go out there and win 3 times this year, I feel like learning how to win, that's something that is priceless. And I've learned so much from all of my experiences this year, and, you know, from the wins and I guess the losses, and being able to play 3 LPGA events as well. So I've learned so much this year, and I'm so grateful. And kind of looking back, I am kind of grateful that happened.
When you see how you're succeeding this year, Gabby, where do you see room for improvement then? Where's the headroom for the next step of competing against the best players in the world on the LPGA Tour?
Yeah, for sure. I see so many areas where I need to improve. I know that a lot of, you know, areas of my game are improving, but, you know, getting to play in the majors, I got to play in the KPMG Women's PGA at the start of the year, and then the U.S. Open as well. And I think to really, you know, compete with some of the best in the world, I think it's just getting a little bit better at the kind of my short game. My pitching, and I would say my putting as well, to be able to consistently perform at the highest level and hopefully win a big championship on the LPGA one day.
Gabby, you were a nationally ranked tennis player. You played until you were about 13 or 14 competitively, and then you made this remarkable transition to golf. In some ways, do you love golf more because you don't have, like, the battle scars, A, or the endless hours of youth golf, that it still seems fresh to you in some way?
For sure. A lot of people have asked me that. I would say I for sure am still pretty fresh. Started playing golf at 15, and everything is still kind of new and exciting, even though I've been playing for, I guess, seven or eight years. But I feel like I wouldn't trade my tennis years for anything. I feel like I've kind of drawn off that and learned off them as well. But definitely feel like I'm more fresh than, say, the girl or guy that's been out there, you know, playing since they were 2 years old. So just kind of trying to keep that mentality, I guess, for the rest of my career.
One of the guys who's been out there playing a little bit longer is your older brother, Ryan, who's playing currently on the Challenge Tour in Europe. What was the bragging rights text like that you exchanged over the weekend to remind him that you're getting the wins?
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm pretty supportive of him. There hasn't really been much bragging, I guess. But no, he's working hard. He's trying to get it done, and I know that he will very, very soon.
Gabby, how much do you still follow tennis? Just curious. Any players that you competed against as a junior that you watched today? Do you stay up late to watch the Grand Slams? Where's your tennis love these days?
I love watching tennis. Yeah, anyone that knows me knows. And my parents also love watching tennis. Tennis is always on in our house. I love watching all the majors. I've been following Carlos Alcaraz. He's amazing. He's going to change tennis. He's such a fun person to watch. And same with Swiatek. They're kind of around my age, so it's fun to kind of see them excel in their sport. And I try and draw, I guess, as much learning things from them and from that sport as possible.
Well, I would ask you for a forehand tip, but that would just be over the top and unnecessary. Gabby, thanks so much for the time. Congrats on the great success this season.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, in case you missed any of the golf over the weekend, we've got you covered with the nine. The nine best shots are coming up next. You won't want to miss it. Quick Lucas Glover story. I was writing a piece for the New York Times at Augusta National 1 year. I did a story on the old oak tree that sits next to the first fairway. Talked to a bunch of people on property. Got to Lucas Glover, who was standing under the tree with me. I said, what do you think about this tree? You know, where all the meetings happen and people come and get some shade and you know, tell stories. And Lucas looks up and goes, I'm not much of a tree guy. And I just, that's who he is. No hemming and hawing, straight to the point. And I love that was the answer he gave yesterday about the Ryder Cup. Yes, he wants to be on that team and believes he can bring a lot to the team and bring a lot to the table. That strong chin, 43 years of age, he's seen the good, bad, and ugly in this game.
There's a lot of Lanny Watkins in Lucas Glover as well. Lanny's very clear-eyed about a lot of subjects. Lucas Glover, very much the same. What impresses me most is that he doesn't pretend he never had the yips, which a lot of players will do. They'll just sort of push it away. Lucas Glover's faced it head on, said this is how bad it was, and we saw the video of how bad it's gotten, and his ability to just compartmentalize it and then work through it and acknowledge it and move on.
And not even afraid to use the word. I mean, there's some weird sports psychology going on there, because you imagine some people say, put it out of your mind. He's not even afraid to say yips. It's like his word, not ours. That shows you how strong he is also in the belief in what he's doing now.
Yeah, that's the great thing that Zach Johnson knows. He's going to be great in any locker room that he's in. Whether or not he makes that locker room for Rome is another question, but there's no doubt whatsoever that he's worthy of being in that locker room right now. He's beating the best players in the world. He had two of them chasing him down the final stretch. Three if you throw in Jordan Spieth as well. There are at least three guys who will be in Rome that we know that probably would expect to see Lucas Glover there alongside them. Rory McIlroy might not want to see him since he's on the other side.
Zach Johnson has options. That's a good thing. Enjoy your day. We're back noon tomorrow. We'll see you then.